Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight, and I'm your host, Randall White. Thanksgiving is 2 weeks from today. For many, there's an annual tradition for that long holiday weekend of heading up to Sierra ski resorts to kick off the winter season. But this year, COVID-19 will complicate those plans for some. And there's always the question nowadays as to whether there'll be any snow to actually ski on. In fact, AAA Northern California says travel on Thanksgiving will be on the lighter side this year and anticipates a 10% drop in travel nationwide. That's the most extensive one-year decrease since the 2008 Great Recession. Later on Insight, we'll dive into the coming Tahoe tourist season and how it might play out in the coming weeks and months. But first, in 2018, the California Democrats won back a supermajority in the legislature. This time around, they were looking to expand that even further. With a supermajority, the legislature can override a governor's veto, something that might come in handy for Democrats if California were to elect a Republican governor during the next gubernatorial race. Here to explain more about supermajorities and what happened during the election earlier this month is Cap Radio's politics reporter and co-host of the California State of Mind podcast, Nicole Nixon. And Nicole, we're pulling you away from your podcast production just a day before you drop the next episode. So thank you for giving us some of your time this morning to help really put this recent election into some perspective.
No problem. Happy to be here, Randall.
So I guess it's always nice to have more power, but were there specific reasons why Democrats were looking to expand that supermajority?
Well, you know, just like every political party, the Democrats have an agenda that they want to push forward. And they already have the supermajority, like you mentioned. So they're already able to do that pretty easily. Although should be said that there are still a wide range of ideological differences between Democrats in California, in the California legislature. But the bigger their supermajority, the easier it is for them to pass controversial bills, and especially the state budget, which needs a two-thirds majority to vote and accounts for $200 million of spending in this state.
Yeah. Some seats, you know, Democrat or Republican, are locked in, super safe. People have been voting, you know, for that party in that district for a really long time. So how many seats were they looking to flip where the person that was currently in power seemed vulnerable?
Yeah, well, I was watching four state Senate seats in particular that really looked like they could flip from Republican to Democrat this election. They're all in Southern California. Two of them are in Orange County, which I think has become the new battleground area after being a Republican stronghold for so long. But if Democrats won all of these seats, they would have the largest majority in the state Senate in a very, very long time. And how it's looking right now is it looks like Democrats will pick up two seats in the state Senate. Again, there are still votes to count. These are all very close races, as you would imagine, in battleground districts.
And this is as a whole, not the two that you were looking at, but as a whole, Democrats would have two additional seats than they had in the previous session.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there are two Republican Senate incumbents that look like they may lose their seats. One of them is in Orange County. This is interesting because this was a seat that Democrats won in 2016. The candidate there is Democrat Dave Min. The one that Democrats won in 2016 is Josh Newman. He won in 2016. He was recalled in 2018.
Right.
He is now winning the seat by 10,000 votes. He's up about 10,000 votes. So it looks like he may pick that up. But again, these are not official. The other interesting one is Dave Min is the Democrat there. He's currently leading by 13,000 votes over Republican incumbent John Morlock, who's been a Republican official for a long time. And Dave Min has declared victory. Morlock hasn't conceded yet, to my knowledge. Then the other two races that I'm watching very close again, but they're right now in Republicans' favor. So it looks like Republicans might hold on to those, but there are still ballots left to count.
Yeah. Nicole, this past spring, the legislature chose not to convene in person, right? And then during the summer, there was some back and forth, and we had another spike in cases, and then some people tested positive at the Capitol. So the legislature is supposed to convene in early January next. How might things be different with the pandemic?
Well, I think that that's really the big question as we turn our attention from the election to the next legislative session. Yeah, legislative leaders took extended recesses twice earlier this year over fears of the pandemic. They extended their spring recess, and then they extended their summer recess after two lawmakers tested positive. And I know that lawmakers and staff who work in the Capitol are very concerned about working in a cramped sort of workspace like that. There's not a lot of room. It's close quarters in the Capitol on the floors. And they have moved committee hearings from, you know, the smaller rooms to the chamber floors where they can socially distance. And then also another crazy thing that happened is that the last week of the session, a Republican senator tested positive. He had gathered with almost his entire GOP caucus. So Republicans were forced to participate in the last few floor sessions virtually. And it made for a very chaotic night of the final session. If you can imagine how crazy some Zoom meetings are with people talking over each other.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting and chaotic experience. So
we talk about Democrats and Republicans being figuratively divided, but in this case they were physically divided. Like the Republicans were not allowed in the room.
Yeah, and they were really unhappy about that. But you know, with cases on the rise again nationally and in California, I think that all of this will have to be a big consideration for legislative leadership. What do they do? There are high-risk lawmakers and high-risk staff working in the state capitol that they have to keep safe.
Yeah.
We
talk about how different it is for the legislators. You're covering them. How different is it for you to, you know, get the very latest? I know a big part of reporting is developing those relationships and, you know, being able to get the information, being a trustworthy source, things like that. How does all that work?
Yeah, I mean, well, thankfully, the legislature streams all their meetings and it's accessible that way. I've struggled with that this year. There's just nothing replaces being on the ground. Sometimes you can just feel when something's going on. I remember in March before they voted to extend their recess, there's an energy that you can just tell what's going on. I know something's afoot here. And
yeah, people are being short with me.
Right? Yeah, something's happening exactly. Here. Where are these people? I don't see them. They must be in a caucus somewhere discussing something important that's about to happen.
Yeah. So.
But you don't get that.
No. So something important is about to happen, will happen, you know, in the coming months. What are you looking forward to covering once everyone's back in business?
Yeah, well, I think in January, we'll see a lot of emergency management type stuff. You know, how will lawmakers vote to help Californians through the pandemic? Wildfire mitigation. There's been talk of spending a lot more money on land management and helping people protect their homes from wildfires. I've also been covering police reforms. There's a big police decertification bill that didn't make it through in the chaos of that final night of the session. This is something that a lot of states have that California does not, and that is a process to strip badges of police who are convicted of crimes or found to have done misconduct, a way to sort of root out the bad apple cops, as you say. And then, of course, there's the usual business, the state budget, which will look very different under the pandemic. We had a huge deficit, $54 billion this year. I know that state tax revenues have looked better than fiscal analysts projected in the past few months. So I think lawmakers are hoping that they have a little more to work with than what was expected earlier this year, but it still is probably not going to look like a very good picture for them moving forward on the state budget.
Yeah. Speaking of the budget, Nicole, and I don't need you to get too deep in the weeds, but we had that rainy day fund, of course. We were not allowed to use it all at once. So that means there's still some of it there, right?
Yeah, I think lawmakers took about half of it to plug that deficit this time. So there should be about $8 billion. And I know that Governor Newsom had said that he really wanted to sort of spread that out to make it last 2-3 years if possible. And, you know, with the pandemic going the way it is, I think there is a lot of fear that this could be a crisis that's dragged out,
yeah,
and the recovery will be slow.
So as I mentioned, you're going to drop a new episode of California State of Mind tomorrow. Can you give us a little sneak peek as to what we might hear?
Yeah, so this week we had a great discussion on the future of the Affordable Care Act. California's Attorney General was arguing before the Supreme Court this week in a case that could determine the future of that law, and there's a lot at stake for California. I also spoke with East Bay Congresswoman Barbara Lee. We talked about a lot of things, but I asked her about the fact that Donald Trump peeled off more support from voters who are Black and Latino men this year, and asked her whether Democrats should be worried about their base. And here's what she said.
When you see his moves in the last 4 years, his agenda, what he has done in terms of dismantling the government, in terms of consolidating power within the White House, in terms of trying to ignore the three branches of government in our democracy, clearly he is acting as strongmen act and as dictators act, and it's outrageous. It's un-American, and the Republicans, of all people, if they consider themselves patriots and if they consider themselves upholding the Constitution and this democratic form of government, then they should weigh in and say enough is enough and move forward and engage in this peaceful transition.
Democrat Barbara Lee of Oakland, right?
Yes, that was her talking about the fact that President Donald Trump has not yet conceded this race and what that could mean over the next few weeks. Also, Representative Lee is on just about every list out there right now about who should replace Vice President-elect Kamala Harris in the U.S. Senate. So I asked her about that. You'll have to just download the podcast tomorrow to find out what she said.
All right. Sounds good. Nicole Nixon, Cap Radio's politics reporter and California State of Mind podcast co-host. Thank you for giving us some of your time. I know you're busy, so get back to work on it.
Thanks, Randall.
Up next, with our country deeply divided politically right now, how do we hold constructive conversations with people who hold opposite views from our own? Well, we'll speak with the expert on that, president of the National Conflict Resolution Center in San Diego. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We are coming off months of campaigning, followed by tense weeks of election results, revealing an incredibly divided nation. And really, when you drill down even locally here in California and Nevada, divided neighborhoods. So, Steve Dinkin is president of the National Conflict Resolution Center in San Diego. He also writes a weekly column in the San Diego Union Tribune called A Path Forward that focuses on innovative ways to maintain a sense of civility in our lives we thought somebody with Steve's expertise would be a welcome guest here on Insight after what we've all just been through and are going through. Thank you for joining us this morning, Steve.
Good morning, Randall. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you. I want to know, if we want to connect with our political opposites, who are often family members, longtime friends, coworkers, neighbors, you name it, during these extremely divisive times, you say that we need to consider how we got here, right?
I think it's important to consider how we got here, and we're in a very polarized environment. It's one thing to say we're divided, and I actually embrace division in the sense that that's a strength of our country, that we have different perspectives and we come from different cultures. So in essence, being divided, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that the division has been polarized. It's the weaponization of the division and the fact that now we're a polarized society that is really troubling.
Mm. So let's say we do then want to have a constructive conversation with a political opposite, because as you mentioned, having differing views can make us stronger, you know, when we work together with that. How do you suggest we go about that?
Well, the first step is to actually have the conversation, because what often happens in a polarized society is that we avoid the conversation. And if we avoid conversations, then we just stay within our own silos and it tends to radicalize our own beliefs. Mm-hmm. So engage in the conversation. And to do that, it's to have a constructive conversation. Avoid dehumanizing the other person just because they have a different point of view. Don't reject them outright. Don't assume that they have certain motives. It's critical that we enter into the discussion from a curious point of view and to have a constructive conversation rather antagonistically.
Is it okay to ask somebody, where did you hear that? Because I haven't heard that. Because like you mentioned, we're becoming so polarized and radicalized that the sources of our information are vastly different. And so you might have a conversation with someone, and I've run into this myself. I don't even know how to respond because I've never heard what they're saying. And so a lot, you know, often what I'll do as a reporter is I'll say, well, where did you hear that? What's your source on that? Is that accusatory?
Well, oftentimes if you're having a one-on-one conversation, it's important to take control of your tone and your body language. So it's often how you pose that question. So that question in and of itself is not necessarily a troubling question. It's how you engage in that conversation. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is that social media is exacerbating the situation. The bully pulpit of the presidency is weaponizing the polarization and the division in our society. And so people are getting information from all different sources, and we're all dealing with a different set of facts. And that's one of the challenging issues right now, is that we're not all working with the same factual pattern.
Yeah. I almost never go on Facebook anymore. And for the past few months, and when I do, I only post something positive. That's been my little tactic through the pandemic, I guess, and the election. Why is coming together to heal the country now seen as a citizen duty in your mind?
Well, it's absolutely critical. We're facing some of the most challenging issues of our time. You mentioned earlier in your show about COVID. There's other very seriously challenging issues that we're facing. Mm-hmm. And in order to solve these issues, you can't have 49% of the country not engaged in the resolution. And so it'll take all of the different perspectives and everyone rowing together in the same direction to solve these most intractable problems that we're all facing.
We have been threatened in the past. And I'm thinking about World War II, 9/11. You know, the nation really came together during those times, but it seems like recent threats like COVID that we just mentioned don't really have that same effect. Another threat that's causing division is climate change. Why doesn't a threat like this have the same unifying results that the others might?
There's been a evolution of our connectivity over the last century, over the last many years. And what's happened is that demographics has changed. And so we're now separated more through rural and urban environments. Also, economically, there's a smaller middle class. And on top of that, there's exacerbating causes of what I mentioned before, the social media, the bully pulpit of the presidency. And so we're in an antagonistic environment. All these forces are taking place. And so it's more challenging as a society to connect with one another around these challenging issues. So years ago, it was easier to connect as a nation, but all these factors that we're facing today is making it so challenging for us to come to solutions.
Steve, would you recommend meeting with people on a fairly regular basis that aren't like you? And I know this is hard to do during a pandemic, but I'm thinking about, you know, maybe don't go to your corner coffee shop that you always do. Choose a coffee shop that's in a neighborhood that you would really never go to. Find ways to meet people and develop relationships that just, they are nothing like you.
I think that's absolutely critical. We've embraced the idea of community conversations. If we're not engaging in dialogue, especially with people who have different perspectives and different points of view, then we're not moving forward as a nation. And let's not just rely on social media where the person is anonymous on the other side. Let's engage in a face-to-face conversation. Maybe it's through a Zoom type conversation if we can't be together at this moment. But when we are able to be together, having the face-to-face conversation is so critical. And when you have that conversation, you know, it's important to be curious, to ask questions, to listen, to engage the other person, to acknowledge differences. And as long as you do that, we're going to find common ground. There are similarities in our perspectives. We might not have the same path forward in terms of how we get to the end game, but it's critical that we get there. And we're not going to be able to do that if we're not having the conversation, if we're rejecting other people, condemning them, dehumanizing them, if they have a different point of view. We need to engage in the conversation. It's the only way through that back and forth dialogue from different perspectives that we're going to find solutions to these challenging issues.
Where do you think the national conversation is going in 2021? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about this division?
I'm optimistic in the sense that people are increasingly frustrated. At the National Conflict Resolution Center, we've actually never been busier because people are looking for solutions. They're looking for a more civil approach to dialogue and debate. And people are frustrated with the current environment and they're looking for solutions. So I'm optimistic that the coming year, we're going to move through this and start to find some of these critical solutions.
Stephen Dinkin is the president of the National Conflict Resolution Center in San Diego. He also writes a weekly column in the San Diego Union Tribune called A Path Forward that focuses on innovative ways to maintain a sense of civility in our lives. Stephen, thank you so much this morning.
Thank you, Randall.
You know, somebody who reports on climate change regularly and has certainly experienced his fair share of conflict over the issue is CAP Radio's environment reporter and host of the Tahoe Land podcast, Ezra David Romero. Ezra, we want to bring you into the conversation now because for the rest of the show, we're going to discuss the Tahoe region's economy and how it's affected by climate change and, of course, COVID-19 as we prepare to start another ski season. So, Ezra, I want to start. Your reporting has found that it's really a crapshoot each year for resorts in the Sierra as to how robust the snowpack might be, right?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, you should say. You know, in the past 10 years, we've seen some really great snowpacks and some really small ones, right? And some scientists from the UC Davis Research Center up there have talked about how in the past years, there's been about 50% less snow, and then how by mid-century, that could be cut in half even more. And so with the ski-based economy, all of the, you know, everything depends on that, or so much does, I should say. And there is work to change that or have it rely on other things. And then the other part of the issue is that the more the snow actually sticks on the ground is moving higher and higher up the mountain. So ski resorts and snow places that are based on the snow-based economy, you know, they sort of dwindle when that snow is not there.
Yeah, I was at a bar at the top of one of the resorts right at State Line there on the South Shore. And the bartender had worked there for a really long time. And he told me to look down. And he goes, you see that, you know, the highway right there, the stretch that comes in from California? He goes, for years, he's been up there for like decades. And he goes, for years, I would see snow down there on the ground. But in past winters, you don't. So he's in his lifetime, he's seeing this, the snow line that you talked about, move up from street level there where the casinos are.
Yeah, that's downtown South Lake Tahoe is one of the places you can see that the most. You know, I met scientists. If you heard some noise, that's my cat running around.
Oh.
You hear these businesses that, like a sleigh riding company that is closing down and diversifying their operations and doing carriage rides, and people are just being creative in these years when the snow just isn't there.
Yeah, they have to adapt to the variable seasons. I guess you can only move the mountains so much higher, though, you know, like the ski lifts and that sort of thing. So, Ezra, you spoke yesterday with a top climatologist about how this coming season might pan out. What did you hear there?
Yeah, I talked to UCLA's Daniel Swain. He studies climate science there. He was saying that it's going to be cold this winter because of La Nina out on the ocean. You know, it's where it's colder and the winds bring in this cold air, and it's usually drier, he said. But even though that's forecast to be sort of this dry, cold winter, it still will most likely be wetter than we've seen in the past year. You know, last year was this really dry winter where we didn't get much rain, right? Where ski resorts were closed, all that kind of stuff. He says this year, well, because it's colder, like, we may see more snow stick on the ground, and that depends on how long it's cold for. So yeah, he says to prepare for a dry, cold winter, but it still could be wetter than in years past. And one thing he said is interesting is, like, even though it's going to be cold, when you look at the historical record of coldness, I should say, it's not that cold compared to all the years in the past, right? So it's because of climate change. Like, it's going to be cold, but it's not that cold. It's just sort of this interesting perspective on
it's
that. And
cold,
I think the next guest might talk about that too.
Yeah, it's cold in a sense of what we're sort of used to here in modern times over the last few years. But
immediacy, yeah. So, like, compared to last year, it may feel really cold, and snow may be on the ground later in the year, later in the spring, when usually we see it melting.
Yeah.
So that could be a change, and that could be really good for ski resorts, right? To be guaranteed that there will be snow and that it's going to stick. You know, that's why places like ski resorts create snow when the cold temperatures are cold enough for it to stick and to stay. So it could be a positive thing.
Yeah, your Tahoe Land podcast was fantastic, and it even though it was put out a little while back, it still completely holds up. So people, if they haven't listened, should listen now. And it's science-based. I'm wondering, you know, when you put out a podcast like that, you hear from people when they've listened to it. Did you get much pushback in terms of the science and how the climate is changing up at Tahoe?
You know, we got that question a lot in the process, and there was a little bit of pushback, but not really. I mean, even when we talked to, say, the congressman over the area who doesn't believe in human-caused climate change, you know, he is still seeing the effects of climate change on his region, whether it's dying trees, whether it's the snow changing. So they may dispute, like, whether climate change is cut real, like, through burning fossil fuels, but they're seeing the effects. So they're having their economy hit by all this. So they're working to sort of remedy these problems. Mm-hmm. And so I was surprised in the whole process, the very little pushback we got on the science-based approach. But this, we based it off of this big report that had something like 100 scientists working on it, city leaders, people who live in the community. And I think what in Tahoe, what's so interesting is that there's so many people there that are witnessing, living this encounter, like the person, like that bartender you were saying, right. You know, whether I was talking to someone at the gas station or whether I was talking to a scientist out on the lake or on the top of a mountain, snowshoeing with them or doing whatever, they all understood that something is changing here.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the hypothesis of this podcast, was to explore that change and how it's impacting a community and what can be done into the future to adapt.
That was Republican Tom McClintock that you spoke to? Uh-huh. Fourth District Congressman.
Exactly.
Ezra David Romero. He is Cap Radio's environment reporter and host of the Tahoe Land podcast. Ezra, thank you. And pet your cat for us.
I will. Thanks.
All right. To help us get a better idea of the long-term changes in California's climate and what it means for snowpack this winter and other impacts like droughts and flooding, we now turn to Noah Diffenbaugh. He's a climate scientist and professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So you just heard what your former Stanford colleague, now UCLA, Daniel Swain, had to say about the Sierra's snow this year. What are you expecting this winter in terms of snowpack in this expected La Nina weather pattern?
I think Daniel's summary that Ezra conveyed, mm-hmm. is right on. And I think that your discussion about what scholars call the shifting baseline, not just the shifting baseline of climate, but the shifting baseline of our perception of what's normal, is really critical. And what we're seeing in terms of the long-term trends is, a climate in California that is not only warmer, but, has less reliable snowpack. This is both because the snow that does fall either, it doesn't build up because of the warm temperatures, or when it does build up, it melts earlier in the year. And it's also because the storms that deliver precipitation are getting warmer. And that's, recent research from my group at Stanford, but on which Daniel's a co-author.
The Pineapple Express?
Well, so the atmospheric river storms that are responsible for the vast majority of the precipitation that we receive and the lack of atmospheric rivers are responsible for the droughts that we experience. Those have been getting warmer. And when we look back at the historical record of the atmosphere, the atmospheric observations, we find that in fact those storms are getting warmer. So what that means is not only is that snow line, where there is snow persistent throughout the winter that you all were talking about, not only is that getting higher, like in the bar at the ski resort that you described. But there's also research, not from our group, but from colleagues, that shows that the rain snow line is moving up in elevation as well. So there are really two factors that are both related to warming. One is storms that deliver precipitation, do they deliver snow or rain, and at which elevation? And then the second is when there is snow that occurs, how long does it last? Mm-hmm. And that's broadly important for water resources in California overall, both in terms of the water storage that snow provides, as well as the flood control.
Yeah, we've really built our whole system around having healthy snow.
Exactly. Our water system in California is designed and built around that natural reservoir. I think most listeners are familiar with that in terms of water storage, and California Department of Water Resources estimate is that about 30% of California's water supply is dependent on snowpack. Something that is the other side of that coin that is less frequently discussed is the role of snow in preventing flooding, mm-hmm. right? Because snow holds that water, right?
Yeah.
And other research from my group this year, you know, we've looked back at the history of flooding and which floods were related to precipitation coming as rain, which floods were related to snow melting, which floods were related to rain falling on snow and causing snow melt. And in fact, we do find that the higher the percentage of rain in a precipitation event, the greater the flooding. So we're seeing this trend historically. We can expect to see it intensifying in the future. So that's the broad landscape of snow and our water resources in California.
So, Professor, just to reiterate, you agree with Daniel Swain in terms of it looks like we'll have a drier and colder winter over the next few months.
I'll just say as Daniel Swain's PhD advisor at Stanford, I agree with Daniel Swain. so you're not gonna get me on the air live to say that I don't agree with Daniel Swain. So what Ezra conveyed, I think the main point is that we're in a different climate now.
Yeah.
And even what has been even the total amount of precipitation in a given season that might have produced a reliable snowpack or a reliable fraction of snow accumulation, we can't count on even for that same amount of precipitation. So we're in a climate now where it's not just whether it's a wet or dry year, it's also the temperature really, really matters, because we get a wet year like we got in 2017 when we had the Oroville crisis, right? And those, the issue there was getting storms that were warm,
mm-hmm.
right? And
the lake went over its banks.
Alex Hall's group at UCLA has shown that the historical warming of California contributed appreciably to that Oroville crisis, right? The runoff was more because of the global warming that's happened. So that's a reality of the changing climate, and the reality of our infrastructure and management systems is we can't just we can't just remake California's infrastructure in a year or two.
Mm-hmm. And this is happening
adjust.
So quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what La Nina means for how much precipitation we'll get is critical.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you were saying earlier, what Ezra was conveying about a cold year relative to recent years, does not necessarily mean a cold enough year to really create reliable snowpack. I'm waiting with bated breath to see what happens. But I think that what we've learned about the long-term trends is informative, which is that we need to be prepared for the storms that do arrive being warmer, and the snow that does fall not lasting as long into the late spring.
Our changing norms. Noah Diffenbaugh, climate scientist and professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University. We appreciate your take on this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead, with COVID cases spiking in many regions of the state, how will the state's 30-plus ski resorts respond? We'll hear from an industry expert, and we'll do our seasonal check-in with a small business owner in Tahoe City who keeps rolling with the changes. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Ever since the COVID shutdowns started in March, businesses and industries have been forced to adapt and change. In Tahoe, that means businesses who relied on the tourism industry were especially hard hit. If you've listened to Insight regularly, you may recall our conversations with Alex Hunt. He is co-owner of Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery in Tahoe City. A few weeks into the lockdowns, Alex told us he thought he only had maybe 2 weeks to survive financially. Months later, we checked in on him again, and they had adapted and were doing okay. And now with ski season on the horizon, but with COVID surging again, we wanted to check back in with Alex for another update. So, Alex, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Randall. Nice to talk to you again.
Likewise. Yeah, so tell us about your restaurant and how things are going now, about 8 months into the shutdowns.
Like we spoke last time, summer for us was pretty good at the restaurant. Pizza, as far as takeout goes, kind of goes hand in hand. And so we did fairly well, weathering the storm, like a lot of the restaurants up here did. The hardest thing for us is kind of just mitigating kind of the counties shutting down and changing our tiers and stuff like that, much like the customers that come into our shop and ask us, do they have to wear a mask? Are they allowed to come inside? Do they have to stay outside? Can they eat inside? Can they eat outside? For us as well, it's constantly changing. And so we're always trying to roll with the punches as well. And that's kind of the hard thing that we're kind of dealing with. And with the recent change of going back to 25% occupancy, it's another thing that we have to adapt to. But I think, us, much like a lot of the restaurants up here, are trying to stay creative and doing what we can to stay viable during this time.
Yeah, you're in Tahoe City, which is Placer County, which got shifted to red, as you mentioned, which means 25% capacity. But the size inside your spot there, that would mean one or two people, right?
Yeah, so we are a very, very small facility, maybe 850 square feet, and that includes our kitchen. And so with that said, we only have one or two tables inside, and including our employees, which is myself and my other employee, Connor, in there, we can only have about another five people in the restaurant max at a time. And so with that said, we're really trying to limit the amount of people eating inside. If you're getting a quick slice, you're welcome to eat real quick. And then we just ask people to keep it moving so we can accommodate, with our small space. But for the most part, so long as we verbalize everything to our customer and, we're friendly about it, everybody's been very understanding to the situations and has been very willing to work with us with what we have to do with the constant changes.
So Thanksgiving, 2 weeks from today, what are your hopes for the upcoming tourism season?
Well, so it looks like, things are really cooling down around here, and we've got some snow on the ground that's sticking around. And for this time of year, that's fairly unusual. We've got a lot of the resorts that are blowing pretty hard. Now, whether or not they're going to be open for Thanksgiving, that's up for debate. And there's a lot of restrictions right now that the ski resorts are trying to impose just to try to stay compliant with all the COVID regulations, and understandably so.
Yeah.
And so with that said, Thanksgiving for us is usually a good little push around here before we have a pretty decent quiet time before we hit a Christmas. And so for us, Thanksgiving should be pretty good. We get a lot of people that come up and do the Airbnb thing and stay with family. However, with the new CDC guidelines and people trying to really limit the number of gatherings as far as the people go, I think it'll be a little bit more on the mellower side that we've seen mm-hmm. in years past. But with that said, we definitely will still see people. And for ourselves at the shop, we will be open for anybody that doesn't have any family to go see or is trying to be safe. You know, we can definitely provide some takeout food for you at the shop. So,
Alex, before I let you go, I just want to know, did you think you'd make it to November?
You know, I'll be completely honest with you, Randall. In the beginning, I was really trying to grapple the fact that, you know, we might have to shut down and look at some financial options to try to keep the store open, you know, other than just, you know, going off of the sales that we were doing. And as a small business owner, only being open for 3.5 years, you know, your safety net financially isn't as big as you'd like it mm-hmm. to be. And so you start thinking about, you know, is it worth it to keep the doors open, or is it something where you just kind of bite the bullet, close up shop and hope for the best and try again somewhere else at a different time when it seems more of a viable option? And so, you know, in the beginning, I really did struggle with that. We, you know, decided to cut down our employees, try to really cut our overhead so we could try to make it as operational as we could during that time. And we were able to do that. And with the community's support, especially up here, you know, and making it known that we were going to try to do that and stay open and give the safe option to our customers, people really were accepting to it and really willing to help push us through that time. And so, you know, we couldn't have done it by ourselves. And so with that, we were thinking about, didn't think that we were going to make it till November, but I feel very blessed and I feel very happy that we did.
Well, terrific. We hope you make it to many Novembers. Alex Hunt is the co-owner of Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery in Tahoe City. Thanks for being with us again for the seasonal update.
Thank you very much. Hope to talk to you guys again in a couple months.
All righty. Let's now hear from Event and Media Relations Manager for the Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority, Mike Fry. Welcome to Insight, Mike.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting for me to be on NPR. I spent a lot of my work life at Kirkwood Mountain Resort, and you guys were my drive.
Oh, well, we'd love to hear that. Yeah, thank you.
South Lake Tahoe, and I loved the commentary, and so this is very cool to me. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we're happy to have you here, and you're joined by the president of Ski California, Mike Reitzel. Welcome as well, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we've got Mike and Mike, so I'm going to use your last names, if that's okay. Mike Fry.
Mine's really easy. How can you not pronounce my name?
Right, Mike Fry. No, it's super easy. Hey, do you expect skiers to take to the slopes this year in the same, say, pre-pandemic numbers as you've seen before?
We expect skiers to come here like crazy. And that means even though Vail has a reservation system, we think that they'll do a good job of managing it so that people can ski safely and responsibly, but we expect to be very busy this winter.
Mm-hmm. And statewide, Mike Reitzel?
I think it's true across the state. I mean, people are certainly interested in getting outdoors. You know, once the summer hit, that certainly happened. We saw that. And when it comes to winter, your options become a little less when it comes to outdoors. So we certainly expect to see that up and down the state.
Yeah. Mike Fry, I'm wondering, the Tahoe area was actively asking people to stay away earlier in the pandemic. How will your messaging change heading into the key winter tourist season?
Actually, Randall, messaging's already changed. And what we're asking people to do is to behave responsibly so that we can stay open and they do have an outlet for their fun and recreation. And we have this terrific, if you go to TahoeSouth.com, we have all these really cool Know Before You Go pages that will enlighten people. So they're making good choices about how to optimize their opportunity while they're here.
Mike Fry, lodges, ski rental shops. My experience is they're usually crowded, steam on the windows from people breathing. What will that scene look like?
Vail has already announced in their platforms that to go inside any of their businesses, to line up in front of their businesses, there will be spacing and one must wear a mask. So even on the mountain, if you're in a lift line, there will be expectations that your face is covered.
Mike Reitzel, I'm sorry, we just have a little bit of time left and I want to give Mike Reitzel an opportunity to respond to that.
Well, I certainly want to, Mike said, you know, before you go, that is the message that we're putting out there for everybody. That's the big difference this year. This is not the year to sit around on a Friday night and decide to jump in your car at 6 a.m. in the morning without actually paying attention to what's going on out there. You've got to know what each resort is doing before you go. And I'll say the best thing is, you know, in March when we voluntarily shut down, you know, everyone needs to think about what was our mindset back then as a people, as a society. It was way different. You know, we've learned so much of what we need to do. And I think our industry and our people are ready for that. We've had the benefit of having planning, you know, to get to this point. And so we're ready for that. And we really hope the guest is.
All right. Mike and Mike. Mike Fry, event and media relations manager for the Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority, and Mike Reitzel, president of Ski California. Thank you both so much. Here's to a great season. Let's hope everything pans out.
Thanks very much. And here's to shredding snow. Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
That's Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, our managing editor, RM Sarkissian. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.